Spirits, 1115 West Windsor Road in Champaign, featuring an international selection of wines, beer, and spirits, plus a gourmet deli and Café Soleil, serving a lunch and light dinner menu. More information on the web at sunsingerwines.com. Today's programming is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering a collection of products from more than 30 third world countries, from Vietnamese ceramics and textiles to Bolivian musical instruments and international home decor.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. You'll also find us online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Our guest in this portion of the program is Sarah Centillis. She was a recent graduate of Yale when she signed on with the Teach for America program. She was assigned to a school in Compton, California. Her first classroom with 36 first grade students had no books. There were bullet holes in the door. In the second year of her two-year commitment, she taught at another school in Compton where her students were second graders. In this classroom, the wooden beams across the ceiling were being eaten by termites, and the floor was collapsing. You couldn't see out of the windows. They had been permanently shuttered. Sarah Centillis is the author of the memoir now, Taught by America. In the book, she shares what she learned about poverty and the problems of our poorest school systems. She also writes about how the experience changed the course of her life. Bill Ayers is a professor of education at the University of Illinois at Chicago who has written extensively about urban public schools, and I'd like to share here with you some of what he has had to say about this book because he summarizes it so well. He says, Taught by America is a book of teachable moments. Here, the most sparkling teachable moments belong to the teacher herself. Powered by idealism, Sarah Centillis discovers the limits and potential corruption of a savior complex. Struggling to meet the vast needs of her students and their families, she comes to see that an indifferent and hostile system is a form of violence that can undo both good intentions and hard work. That from Bill Ayers. Listeners, I look forward to hearing from you this afternoon. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. Your questions and comments are invited. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside Champaign-Urbana, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Sarah Centillis graduated from Yale in 1995. She earned a Master of Divinity in 2001 from Harvard Divinity School. She's now at work on her doctorate in theology. Taught by America is her first book. The publisher is The Beacon Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Sarah, welcome. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. After you finished your undergraduate work at Yale, you wanted a break before pursuing an advanced degree. How was it that you decided you'd spend that time working for Teach for America?
Well, when I graduated from Yale, I thought that I wanted time off before I would get a degree in comparative literature. And I soon discovered teaching was anything but time off, but I didn't know that yet. And I really had a feeling that I wanted to do work that mattered. So I went to career services at Yale with that idea in my head. But it's really hard to look for a job in which you'll do work that matters. And it seemed in the career services office like I had two choices. I could go into investment banking or the Peace Corps. And Teach for America seemed like a happy medium between those two extremes. I think Teach for America does a really good job capitalizing on the idealism that students feel when they're about to graduate from college, that feeling that you really want to make a difference in the world. I think in my case, however, the idealism didn't come with much critical reflection, and it functioned as a kind of racism.
Mm. Well, tell us more about that. Expand on that.
Well, I went to Yale, and I was kind of your typical overachiever, perfectionist, first child type, and I hadn't really ever failed at anything before. So when I started doing Teach for America, I had only 6 weeks of training as a teacher that's provided by Teach for America. So I showed up at my classroom very ill-prepared. However, I had a kind of arrogance that really got in my way. I wanted to do well, or for people to think that I was doing well, more than I wanted critical feedback. And so when the principal or the one mentor I had would show up in my room, I really kind of put on a performance for them so that I would get a good grade, even though I wasn't getting graded anymore. I think one thing that Teach for America does that I'm pretty critical about is set up a situation where you're expecting to have an experience of personal triumph. That's this kind of the myth around the experience of teaching for 2 years, but you're set up to have this personal triumph experience in the middle of systemic failure, and that kind of triumph comes at great cost.
Yeah. Have you talked with people at Teach for America about your feelings? Has anybody read your book there?
Oh, I'm not sure. I've done several readings around the country, and there's usually at least one person from Teach for America in the audience. And I have a lot of critiques of the program, and they haven't been very willing to engage my critiques. At least the people who've come to the readings haven't.
Hmm. Would you do it again?
That's a good question. I have kind of a two-part answer to it. My selfish answer is I would do it again. I think it transformed my life in a way that I'm very thankful for. It made me a critical citizen in a way that I'm not sure I could have become one without that experience. So that's my selfish answer. But my unselfish answer when I have my students in my mind is that, no, I wouldn't do it again. I think that they deserve the best kind of teacher, not an ill-prepared one.
Yeah. Well, teachers are human beings. You know?
Yeah, that's true.
And I would be like Mrs. Gutierrez. I would want my child in your classroom.
Oh, thank you.
You're pretty hard on yourself.
Well, it's funny. In almost every time I talk with someone who's read the book, that comes up where it seems very important to people that I believe that I did a good job. And I think when all said and done, I did do a good job. I mean, I taught my first graders and my second graders how to read and add and subtract, and I love them very much. I just think that I could have done much better if I had been better prepared, and that my students deserve the best kind of teacher, not someone who was learning how to teach in their classroom.
What did they teach you?
They taught me a lot of things. I think they taught me the power of hope. They have tremendous hope and joy in the face of incredible odds. I think they taught me how to map my own privilege on their poverty. I think I had known about poverty as a problem intellectually, but I hadn't understood poverty and wealth as a problem. I hadn't understood my own privilege as a result of the kind of oppression that they were experiencing. And I think that was the most intense lesson that I learned during my time in Compton.
Yeah. The children in your first grade class, when they came to school on the first day of school, were they prepared for school?
No. When I showed up at first grade, I'd been in school for 3 years before that. I was in 2 years of preschool and then kindergarten. So by the time I came to first grade, it was my fourth year in school, and I was comfortable with school and knew how to sit in a chair and hold a pencil and all that kind of stuff that we learn in preschool. And for a lot of my students, first grade, the first day of first grade was their first day of school ever. And so we were starting off already at a place far behind where some of their peers in the country are.
Yeah. In California's public schools, is there kindergarten?
I'm not sure exactly now if there's kindergarten. When I was there, they were working to make Head Start a priority, but my students hadn't benefited from that program yet.
Yeah. You know, I know this happens, but it still is very shocking to read about it. There's a student that you write about. His name is Marco, and there's a lesson that involves teaching and estimating. Tell us about that.
I like to use a lot of art in my classroom. So part of the state mandated curriculum was to teach about estimation, and so I had each student create kind of an artistic, abstract version of a mouth on a big black piece of construction paper. So they would draw their mouths using white chalk, and then estimate how many teeth they thought they had, count how many teeth they actually had, and then figure out what the difference was. So they had to practice subtraction and estimation. And I was walking around checking on students' progresses, and one of the students, Marco, was sitting quietly, and it had only been going for about a minute. So I started getting upset with him. Marco, what are you doing? You're supposed to be working. And he said, I'm finished. And I said, oh, really, you are? And I looked at this paper, and it said, estimated number of teeth, 3. Actual number of teeth, 3. Difference, 0. And I said, in my ignorance, no one has 3 teeth. And he said, I do. And I asked him to open his mouth, and his mouth was completely empty of teeth. He had 3 teeth, and the rest were black and rotted. And it was one of the moments where I realized really how little I knew and how much my assumptions about where I was and what kind of resources my students had didn't hold.
Yeah, what a shocker. Do kids get any kind of attention regarding their health in the schools where you taught?
No, not in the schools where I was. There was a fabulous nurse in the first school where I was, and she really was one of the adults I really trusted there and handled cases of abuse and making sure children were getting the care that they needed at school and at home. There was also each student qualified for the free meals program, so if they showed up at, before school, they could get a hot breakfast, and they also got a lunch. So I think that made a big difference in many of the students' lives.
Yeah. Were there after-school programs?
Not at my school, no.
Yeah.
I stayed in Los Angeles the third year after I finished, and a friend of mine started an after-school art program called Dreaming in Color, and we went back to the second school where I was and taught after-school art one day a week. But other than that, I didn't know of other after-school programs in my area.
Yeah. Excuse me, I'm having a rough time today. The first school you taught at, Madison Elementary School, and then the second year you were at Garvey Elementary Schools. Would you tell us a little something about these two schools where you taught?
I'm sure. And both of those are not the real names of the schools.
Okay.
But the first school, when I first showed up, it was, it looks like most elementary schools in California, a lot of long buildings with courtyards in between, except in this case, the courtyards were really more like dirt. There wasn't a lot of grass. We didn't have a playground. There were rusted monkey bars and this large expanse of dirt. There was nothing for the kids to do at recess. And in my classroom, it was a small room, and I had 36 students there, mismatched desks. I had to fight to get enough seats for my students. The second school, I thought I would be in better shape. I was recruited to teach there by a fabulous principal. But when I actually showed up there, she had moved to the district level. And that school building actually had been condemned 10 years prior, but had been reopened because Compton was in need of classroom space. So we went to school in a condemned building, and I was in a portable building because the schools are so pressed for space that they keep putting up these so-called temporary buildings that actually become permanent structures. And my classroom had these blue metal shades on it that had been closed and locked, so I had no sunlight. We didn't have an intercom system, so it was impossible to communicate with the office about anything, and it was really hot. I had an air conditioning in that was kind of shoved in the hole in the back of the room, but we couldn't hear each other when it was on, so it was a pretty uncomfortable classroom.
Yeah. Even so, nobody wanted to leave at recess.
No. I started out the year by having a consequence that if you didn't do your homework, you had to stay inside the classroom for recess. But so many people stopped doing their homework in order to stay in the classroom at recess that I had to change the consequence. There was really nothing for them to do, and it was this kind of dirt and asphalt, huge area with hundreds of children running around very bored and hot. So it was very chaotic, and only one or two teachers would be in charge. So my students were actually scared to go there, and I would look out my window a lot of times, or out the door, because I would have it propped open, and they would just be sitting on our classroom number, it was painted on the asphalt, waiting for recess to be over.
And there was also occasional gunfire.
Yeah, there was one recess in particular when I was teaching second grade. They were all getting in trouble, all the second graders, for being too violent. That's what the principal was accusing them of being during recess. And she was yelling at them, "You're too violent, you're too violent." And all of a sudden there was gunfire. And I, she said, "Stay seated, don't run." And I got my kids up and I was just like, "Run, run." And we ran back into the room. And at that moment we had a discussion about guns. And I asked them if they'd ever seen anyone shot. And every single person in the room raised his or her hand because they'd seen or heard someone shot. And I was the only one in the room who hadn't. But what was most surprising to me in my experience was that the gunfire, which is the stereotype of Compton, you know, that it's a gang-filled kind of violent place, was really the least affecting violence for me, that I really discovered poverty as a kind of violence, that forcing kids to go to this kind of school and families working 3-4 jobs to try to make ends meet is what the real violence is. And the gang warfare and the gunshots are an effect of this violence, not the real violence.
Yeah. Where is Compton? What's the city like?
It's what's known as South Central Los Angeles, and it's a city of, I think, about 100,000 people. I could be wrong on that. It started out in the 1950s. It was 100% white, and it slowly transitioned to become 100% African-American. And the community fought really hard to have its own school district and to have African-American people in charge of it, and they won, which it was a great thing. But later, before I showed up at Compton, sometime in the early 1990s, the school district was taken over by the state for reasons of corruption and low school performance. It was the first district in California to be taken over by the state, and it's since been returned. It's in charge of itself now. But it's now predominantly African-American and Latino. About 65% of the people in Compton, Spanish is their first language.
Yeah. And going back to when you first arrived to teach at your first school, you found out that the school expected you to teach students who spoke English and students who spoke Spanish. How was your Spanish?
My Spanish wasn't very good. It got much better quickly, but I discovered that I was in a bilingual classroom. I was one of the only teachers in the school who spoke Spanish, in spite of the fact that 65% of the students there spoke Spanish as their first language. So I had to learn quickly. The parents were wonderful. I think they were so relieved to have someone trying to speak Spanish with them that they were very forgiving and excellent teachers. They really helped me learn Spanish quickly.
Yeah. And your students would come through for you, too. There was at least one student who helped you out as a translator.
Yeah, there were a lot of students who were bilingual, so I was able to pair them with students who spoke Spanish only, and they could help translate what was going on in the classroom, both for me and for the students.
Yeah. This story is so surreal, you know. What was it like, you know, after you finished your Teach for America commitment, when you decided that you would write about it, what was it like going through the experience again and putting it down on paper?
Well, I started writing. I spent the third year after my 2 years with Teach for America working in a cafe and writing. And I started writing really in a self-interested way to kind of heal. I had these very powerful, disturbing, sometimes funny, haunting images and stories in my head, and I needed to get them out of my head. That was my impulse in writing at first. So I spent a year writing and found it to be a very healing experience. During that time, I decided I wanted to be ordained as an Episcopal priest, which is another story, and applied to divinity school, and so ended up driving across the country to attend Harvard Divinity School in Boston. And during that drive, the manuscript for the book, that year of writing, was stolen out of my car. And I actually think that the thief did me a big favor, because the first version of the book, when I was just working to get the stories out of my head, was very angry and full of rage, and I'm not sure it would have been an effective book. I don't think people would have enjoyed reading it at all. I needed more time away from the stories to be able to write it in a way that would let the situation speak for themselves.
Yeah. Well, when you showed up at Harvard Divinity School, you were still pretty angry. Tell us about the decision to switch from comparative literature, an advanced degree, to going to divinity school.
Well, during the time that I was teaching in Compton, I was also going to church, a church called All Saints Pasadena, which is an Episcopal church in Pasadena, California. And I hadn't really ever been big into church or religion growing up. I grew up Catholic, and this was an Episcopal church, but I found it to be a place that was just really alive. It's a very justice-oriented, hopeful kind of church. And that was my first experience of the Episcopal Church. So I thought, well, excuse me, if this is religion, sign me up. It seemed like the church at its best could be a place that could help fight institutional racism and greed and corruption, the kind of which had created cities like Compton. So I thought that I would be a minister, and that would be a way for me to be an agent of justice and transformation in a larger scale way than I felt that I could do as a classroom teacher. So that's what drove my decision.
Yeah. And once you arrived at Harvard Divinity School, you kept asking the question, well, where is God? Where is God in all this holy mess? How did you begin to turn things around and come to the and sort of re-examine your experiences in Compton and, you know, come up with this new manuscript that then became Taught by America?
Well, I think I kept asking, where is God? And Dudley Rose, who was the coordinator of the field education program at the time, kept saying back to me, well, where do you think God is? And that really forced me to do some intense questioning. And during my time at Harvard, my understanding of religion and faith kind of radically changed, and a lot of that was from writing this story. I think I learned to claim faith that is a kind of agency, I guess a two-part kind of faith. One is agency that, you know, kind of we're the ones we're waiting for to make this world a better place. And the other is hope. I think that I started understanding through my students who showed up every day excited to learn and hopeful and filled with love, that not having hope, if I abandoned my own hope, it would be because of my privilege. You know, I can afford not to have hope, and my life will still be all right. It seemed to me that hope, that taking a radical stance of hope is part of my faith.
Yeah. Well, here the students were the teachers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the kids, because this is how the story really becomes so human. Mm-hmm. Our guest this afternoon, let me reintroduce you, Sarah, and then we'll talk about some of the individuals,
okay,
students. Sarah Centillis is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. When she graduated from Yale with her undergraduate degree in 1995, she signed on with the Teach for America program, and she spent 2 years teaching in Compton, California, the first year, first graders, the second year, second graders. She then went, after that experience, she went on to earn a Master of Divinity in 2001 from Harvard Divinity School. She's now at work on her doctorate in theology. She is the author of the memoir, Taught by America, published by the Beacon Press. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your thoughts, your questions, your comments. 333-9455, the number to call in the Champaign Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, is there a particular student you're thinking of at the moment that you would like to talk about?
There's so many. Yeah, that was my hope, really, in the book, that the students would be central, and that there, through their stories, you get a picture of what living in poverty in America is like. There's one student, I guess, that I'm thinking of. Her name is Elise Carter, and she and her sister were in my second grade class, and I think her story both shows kind of the violence of poverty, and also what's at stake in putting people ill-prepared, as I was, in the classroom. And Elise, she was born addicted to drugs. Both she and her sister were. And I was never sure exactly what happened. But they both had trouble in the classroom in kind of opposite ways. Olivia was really quiet and calming, and she was the only person who could calm Elise down. But she wasn't able to really grasp concepts very easily. And Elise had a lot of energy. She couldn't sit still. She moved her head constantly. She was always eating things off the floor or putting her fingers in her mouth. And she moved so much that I actually ended up having to tape a line in the back of the classroom, and we called it Elise's line. And when she felt like she couldn't stay in her seat one more minute, she could get up and go to the back of the room and walk back and forth on that line. But she was extremely bright. But because she couldn't sit still long enough to learn anything, she had a lot of trouble learning in the classroom. Well, she was placed in the RSP program, the Resource Specialist Program, which is Compton's version of special ed, and she met with a woman named Mrs. K every week in the afternoons. I mean, every day she would go for a couple hours in the afternoon, and she just thrived on that attention, and I thrived not having her in the classroom. It made a big difference. Everything seemed a little bit calmer when she wasn't there. And her mom would call me periodically to thank me for what a big difference she was seeing in Elise's behavior at home and in her schoolwork. And I always had to say, it's not me. It's the special education teacher who's just fabulous with her. So one afternoon, I received a note in my box that Elise's time with Mrs. K was going to be reduced from 5 days a week to 1 day a week, just 1 hour, from 1 to 2 on, I think it was Tuesdays, whatever day it was, I'm not sure, but 1 day a week, because there weren't enough students to fill the, there weren't enough students for Mrs. K, so she'd have to split her time between our school and another school. And I was shocked because I had already referred, I think, 7 or 8 of my own students, and I knew other teachers who had done the same, and none of the paperwork for our students had been processed yet. Elise was only in this program because her first grade teacher had started the paperwork for her, which had taken a year. So she was back in my room and really having a hard time. My class was having a hard time. Elise was having a hard time because a classroom with over 30 students and one teacher can't meet her educational needs. So it was just, it was very difficult, and there was nothing that I could do.
Hmm. I want you to talk about another of your students who really tugged at my heartstrings, Obsidian.
Obsidian. Obsidian was in my second grade class, and she was smart and feisty and very difficult. I had a really hard time with her in the room. She kind of terrorized other students. She terrorized me. She was, I think she had been so hurt in her life that she tried to hurt other people before she could be hurt. And when she first started out in my classroom, on the first day of school, I was holding this sign, and her mom came up to me and looked at me and looked at my sign and looked back at the piece of paper in her hand and was like, oh, no, Obsidian is not going to be in your classroom. And I think she started off, as she should have, distrusting me. I was young. I was white. I had no idea what I was doing. But we really built a close relationship with each other as the year went on. And Obsidian and I developed a close relationship with each other. And as soon as she started to trust me, I think she really thrived in the classroom. She was especially excited about the standardized test that they had to take in California called the CAT 5. The first year that I was teaching, which was the year before I had Obsidian, my students flailed on the test. I wasn't familiar with the test. I hadn't prepared them properly. And the next year, I was determined not to let it happen again. And I had an old copy of the test that I'd taken from the year before, and I really prepped my kids to the test. We worked on it every day. You know, antonyms, synonyms, all the math problems, and I tried to build up their confidence so that they would feel confident when they went to face the test. And Obsidian was most excited about it and worked hard, took extra tests home. And when the test time came around, my school happened to ignore all of the suggestions in the manual. It said, you know, don't test on the day after a weekend, and we started on a weekend, and it was supposed to happen over 2 weeks, but they crammed everything into 1 week. And I had one student who read in English at a ninth grade level, and yet she was tested in Spanish, and it just was a mess. And Obsidian, on the, I think, first day of testing, when they were sitting there for 6 or 7 hours, when it's supposed to be three-hour chunks, trying to take these tests, just burst into tears and just was humiliated and thought everyone was going to think she was stupid and her mom was going to think she was stupid. Mm. And it just broke my heart and reminded me how unstandard standardized tests are.
Yeah. You know, also, what I found myself thinking about was the issue of accountability. Mm. That's one of the reasons we have these tests. And here, you know, reading this story, I find myself asking, who are we holding accountable and for what?
I think that's an excellent point. It seemed to me the tests were just used. The only people held accountable were the students. They were used in a way to show people what they already think they know. The test results are just used to confirm that the students can't learn or they're not smart or they're troubled.
Or Compton is Compton and so on and
exactly.
So forth.
And what can we do about it? But really, they don't show anything. In my experience, they didn't, I'm not sure they could tell anyone anything about the students who were in my classroom.
Yeah. Well, they weren't administered correctly, fairly.
No.
Either.
That's,
yeah.
That's right. They weren't.
Yeah. On top of everything else, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we barely had enough pencils to take the tests. You know, we didn't have books in the room, and yet they were being measured with the same test using to measure students in Beverly Hills who had access to everything they could ever need.
Yeah. The school supplies were provided by you.
Yes.
Did that happen in all the other classrooms? I mean,
yeah, it did. I think if you went into most classrooms in Compton, if there were materials there, the teacher herself had bought them.
Let's go. I want another student I would like you to tell us about. He's one of the first ones we meet in the book, and sadly you say he was the first student you lost. Hmm. Malcolm.
Malcolm was a student in my first grade who he had actually been to kindergarten, and his teacher had worked with him the entire year to get him to write the letter M. It was a product of a long year of work, and that was pretty much all that he could write. He wrote it everywhere. You know, for his name, he wrote M. For the solution to a math problem, he wrote M. He had severe learning disabilities. He couldn't sit still in his seat. He couldn't read. And I had no idea how to reach him. He would always ask me if he could clean the room when other students were working on things that he couldn't do, and I let him, and it's something I'm still ashamed of. I really, in that first year, came to believe that I could keep my students safe and that they really needed me. I think it was part of a savior complex that I hadn't yet deconstructed, and I was scared to leave them, even though I probably needed a day off. And one day, I had to go to a district-sponsored event, I think, for language arts, and I hired a substitute, and I left this long note, you know, I love my class very much, please take good care of them, and I was really anxious about leaving them. And the day after they'd had the substitute, I came back, and one of my students ran up to tell me that Malcolm had left. His dad came and took him out of the school, and they were moving, and I never saw him again. And that was the first time that happened, but it wasn't the last.
Yeah. How did you deconstruct that savior complex?
Well, I started realizing, I think the setup for Teach for America is kind of a colonial model, in that they lead you to believe that these school districts are lucky to have an ill-informed outsider in the classroom. I think that I thought that I had something to offer that they couldn't have gotten without having me in the room. And I soon came to learn that really the person benefiting most from my presence in the classroom was me. I was the one benefiting the most. And that if anyone was being saved, it was me. And I think that's really out of order. And it's something that I continue to struggle with.
Hmm. Have you talked with people who are teachers today about this?
About Teach for America or about the Savior Complex?
About the Savior Complex, about your experience and how, you know, how it all turned out for you and your idea, your criticisms of Teach for America, and you know, with experienced teachers who've been in the classroom, who've made it their life's work.
I've talked with a lot of people about it. I think, you know, I'm definitely not the most among Teach for America, in Teach for America circles, my opinion isn't the most common, although I've gotten a lot of emails from other people who did Teach for America saying that they had a similar experience that I do and have a similar criticism. Seasoned teachers, specifically teachers in the business of training other teachers, are really suspect of this idea that just because you've been in school your whole life, that means that you know how to teach. So they too are questioning this idea that you can learn how to teach in 5 weeks, and wonder, as I do, we wouldn't do that for doctors. You know, we wouldn't think you could train a doctor in 5 weeks and then send them into surgery. And although the consequences of that in surgery are much more sudden, I think the consequences of sending an ill-prepared teacher into classrooms are just as life-threatening as they are in surgery. It just takes a lot longer to manifest.
Yeah. What do you think should go into teacher training? How should we be preparing our young people who want to go into classrooms and make that their work?
I'm not an expert in teacher training,
sure.
But I think that you know, there's the skills that are required for teaching. Teaching is a profession like other professions, and there are some skills that you need in order to be an effective teacher. I also think critical self-awareness is really important. I wish that I had been more self-aware and had deconstructed my motivations for going, my own privilege, and things like that, in addition to the kind of content and skills you need to convey that content.
How aware can you be of those kinds of things, though, at the age of 22?
Yeah, I think there's 22-year-olds that are more aware of it than I was. I grew up in Dallas, which is largely segregated by class and race, and I think oppression and racism and those kind of things were really abstract notions to me. It's not that I didn't know about it, I just chose to ignore it. But I think, you know, there's some colleges that do better than others at preparing critical thinkers. And I was definitely a good critical thinker, but not a critical citizen, if that distinction makes sense.
Yeah. Maybe you'd care to elaborate a little on that.
I think I didn't yet have an understanding that the whole system had been set up to serve me. That that's what I learned experiencing or coming into contact with the students who came through my classrooms, was that everything was set up to get me to Yale, and everything was set up to move them as far away from Yale as possible. And it's devastating for me.
Hmm. Outside of that, are there other things that go into what constitutes a critical citizen?
I think a critical citizen is a big question. I haven't thought about it in this way, but a critical citizen is somebody who approaches the powers that be and the institutions and government and with a sense of a hermeneutics of suspicion, to ask what's at stake and for whom. You know, who's benefiting from these decisions and who's not? Whose suffering is visible, whose isn't? You know, how does my wealth map onto others' poverty? Questions like that, I think, are essential. Instead of, I think, the kind of citizenry that we've created so far in the United States is one where that believes in kind of a meritocracy, that you get money and success because you deserve it, and other people don't because they don't.
We have a listener waiting to talk with us on the toll-free line 4, a caller in McLean County. Let's go and talk with this listener. Hi.
Hi. I got into this, listening to you halfway through the show, so I didn't quite catch on to the whole story about the program, you know, and how it's, I don't know the basis of the program, but I still have a question. And the question for the author is, how do you deal with the pain of knowing that there are kids out there? And I don't, maybe it's not painful for you, but I'm going to assume it is, okay? Because from your voice, I can tell, just that, I mean, from your conversation, I can tell that you're still struggling with it. How do you deal? What do you do to help yourself and help others, knowing that Malcolm is still out there and all those kids are still out there, and there's still kids who don't have paper and pencil and crayons and whatever else they need? And of course, I mean, then the whole bureaucracy of you just said, but helping you get to your destination, but not theirs. And I will hang up and listen.
Okay.
Thank you for your question. I carry these kids around in my head all the time, in my heart. And at the end of the book, I actually talk about going back to Compton to try to find some of them. And I found four of them. Three seem to be doing pretty well, and one seems to be struggling. I think I'm still, to answer the question about what do I do knowing that the kids are still out there, you know, that Compton, I think, repeats itself in cities and rural areas all over the United States. I'm trying to figure out how to respond still. It's something that I still struggle with, figuring out how to be an agent of justice and do work that matters and hold myself accountable to the students who came through my room. I don't mean in an abstract way, but in a material kind of real way, and it's something that I haven't answered yet.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Oh, yeah. I listened to a lot of these interviews on this and the earlier show, and I really think this is probably the best I've heard in a really long time. But mostly it's because especially your ability to analyze what's really going on around you and with you, it's really impressive. I don't know if you've realized that a lot of people will probably think the same thing, but I can't help thinking that if you're going into, I wanted to say that first, but I can't help thinking that if you're going into religion, it'll be a kind of a loss to the rest of us. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about why you would choose to do that, since, well, at least for me, it seems like your ability to work all that out would be so much more effective in, say, politics or even just writing. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much for the show.
Thank you. That's funny to say going into religion is a loss, but I appreciate that. I've actually decided not to get ordained for a lot of reasons. I seem to have trouble with institutions generally, and I experienced a lot of sexism in the church, which is actually the subject of my next book that I'm working on, and I've actually decided to write full-time, at least for now. So thank you for your question.
Okay. Here to wrap up, to summarize what we've been talking about today, is there something you'd like to talk about? Is there something we've not yet touched on that's important to you?
Well, I think the one thing, which I've mentioned a couple times, but I'm not sure I've been clear enough about it, is what I hoped that would come through in the book is not only how incredible the children were who came through my classroom, but also the violence that is poverty, and I think that it's something we really need to talk about in this country. It became painfully obvious during Hurricane Katrina when we saw really in blatant terms what happens when the government fails to meet its side of the social contract, and I think it made really obvious the fact that poor people, people of color, and especially poor people of color have been left behind. And I think in a lot of the school systems in this country, that is happening. The same thing that was happening during Hurricane Katrina is happening in public schools, that students are being left behind, and it's not as sudden as it was in New Orleans or as obvious. It's much more, it's a slow motion kind of abandonment, and lives are at stake. And I hope that is clear in this story.
Yeah. Came through loud and clear to me.
Thank you.
I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. And when that next book comes out, Let's talk again.
Oh, please. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Sarah Centellis has been our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of the memoir Taught by America. The book is published by the Beacon Press. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, Todd Gleason joins us now with prices, settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade. Todd.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade on this Friday afternoon, futures finished in the wheat pit like this. Most of the contracts were unchanged to just slightly higher. The March contract there, a 328 high, low at 324, settlement price at 326.5, and they were unchanged on the day. May futures in the wheat pit to 338.5 high, low at 334.75, settled at 337.25, up a quarter. July, that's your harvest month, 347.5, the high, the low at 344. Settlement price at 346.75. They were up 3/4 for the day. And the September futures, a 357 high, low at 353.5. Settlement price for the SEP wheat at 356.5. The soft red winter wheat up 0.5 cent at the Board of Trade. December contract up 3/4, 369.25. The settlement price, the high at 69.5, the low at 66.5. From the Kansas City Board of Trade, where they trade the hard red winter wheat, that's mostly grown out in the Great Plains states. The March contract at 384.5, high, low at 379. Settlement price at $3.84. They were up a penny in July futures. The harvest month at 381.5. Settlement price down 0.5 for the hard red winter wheat from Kansas City. Board of Trade numbers again now in the corn pit. Chicago corn, March contract 205. The last trade for the day was unchanged with a high of 05.75, a low at 203.5 once again. Settlement price for the Chicago March corn contract 205 unchanged. May futures for the day 215.5 the high. Low at 213.5, settlement price at 215. They were up 0.25 in July, 224.25 the high, the low at 222.5, settled 223.75, unchanged for the day. September corn futures, 233 the high, the low at 31.25, settlement price at $2.32. They were up 0.25 for the day. September futures in the corn pit in Chicago, 233 the high, the low at 31.25, settled at $2.32. They were up 0.25 for the day. December contract, 243, the high, the low at 41.25. Settlement price at 42.5, up 0.25. And the March contract in the corn pit unchanged today, 249.5. The final price, of course, that's March, a year away, 2007. March oats, 191 nearbys at the Chicago Board of Trade on the high, the low at 88.5. Settlement price for the March contract at $1.90.75. They were up 3. The May futures up 1 at 184 for the day. Soy complex now. March contract 571.75, the high, the low at 565.5. They settled at $5.68. They were up 3. The May futures were up 3 as well. 581.5 the high, the low at 75.75. Settlement price at $5.77.75 for the May beans, up 3 cents for the day. July futures a 590.5 high, low at 585.5, at a settlement price at 587.5. They were up 3.5. August contract, 593.5 high, low at 89. Settlement price at $5.90 a bushel, even $2.75 higher for the August beans. September futures, 594 the high, the low at 91. Settlement price at 591.5. They were up 3.25. In the November contract, 601 high, low at 595.5. Settlement price for the new crop November soybeans at $5.97.5. They were up 3.25 today. The January futures for 2007, 606 the high, the low at 01.5. And a settlement price there at $6.03 a bushel. They were up 3 for the day. The rest of the products from the bean pits. March contract in the soybean meal, 180.50 the high, the low at $178. Settlement price at $179.40, and they were up a buck even. May futures up 40 cents today, 182.50 the high, the low at $179.90. And the May bean meal settled at $180.90. They were up 40 once again. Bean oil futures, $21.42 the high, the low at $21.01. Settlement price, $21.28. They were up 20 for the day, and the May contract at $21.78 high, low at $21.38. Settlement price there at $21.63, and they finished 16 higher. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, Todd. Well, here's an overview for you this afternoon as far as the Merc goes, livestock prices. Cattle finished mostly lower, while lean hogs were higher, and February pork bellies finished down $1.27.5.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Okay, let's start now with January feeder cattle. The high, 112.90, the low, 111.90, the settlement, 112.60, that up 15. March, 112.10, the high, 110.40, the low, 111.47 and a half, the settlement, that down 22 and a half. April, 112.85, the high, 111.10, the low, settlement, 112.12 and a half, that down 20. February live cattle, 96.60, the high, 94.80, the low, the settlement, 95.77 and a half, that down 35. April live cattle, 94.95, the high, 93.30, the low, 94.12 and a half, the settlement, that down 52 and a half. February lean hogs, 59.40, the high, 58.80, the low, 59.25, the settlement, that up 60. April 64.30, the high 63.50, the low 63.90, the settlement, that up 32 and a half. May lean hogs 67.45, the high 67, even the low 67.42 and a half, the settlement, that up 62 and a half. June lean hogs 70.40, the high 69.65, today's low, the settlement 70.32 and a half, that up 47 and a half. And February pork bellies 82.42 and a half, the high 81, even the low. The settlement 81.27 and a half, that down 127 and a half. The Dow is off 171 points at 10,710. The NASDAQ off 45 at 2256. The S&P 500 down 19 at 1266.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carl Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's 2 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, 44 degrees in Urbana. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. The producer for the Afternoon Magazine is Harriet Williamson. Our technical director today, Jason Croft. A number of weather advisories top Mike Sola's forecast for Illinois and Indiana. Let's run them down now. A heavy snow warning is in effect in the Chicago metropolitan area this evening through tomorrow morning. A winter storm watch in effect for much of far northern Indiana this evening through late tonight. A winter weather advisory in effect for west central northwestern Illinois and portions of northeastern Illinois and northwestern Indiana this afternoon until early tomorrow. Mike's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon in northwestern Illinois, mostly cloudy with snow arriving. Elsewhere in the north, cloudy with rain and snow arriving, changing to all snow by this evening. In central sections, cloudy with scattered showers this afternoon. And in the south, cloudy with a few showers and thunderstorms, highs ranging from 33 in northwestern Illinois to 60 in the far south. Tonight in northern sections and west central Illinois, snow, heavy at times. In east central Illinois and central Indiana, showers and perhaps a few thunderstorms mixing with, then changing.